It's my special pleasure to introduce to you our panel of keynote speakers and their interlocutor. For too many in our world, religion is a problem. It's a point of tension rather than a solution or a positive source. Religion is implicated, most often too quickly and even wrongly so, in conflicts which capture our attention and our headlines and fill our Facebook and social media pages every single day. It's confusing and complicated and seems all-absorbing. With us today, we have four women who are superstars, who are bold pioneers in advancing the understanding between people of diverse faiths, each quite unique. They are shaping a better world for all of us, building social cohesion, reducing conflict and discrimination, and helping us to be more authentic in our own faithful selves, as Dr. Forbes was calling us to. First, Catherine Marshall. She's quite arguably so the world's foremost expert on the intersection of religion and development. She'll try to tell you that she's the only expert on religion and development, but I'll tell you that she's the world's foremost expert in religion and development. A prolific author, she has a long history with the World Bank and leads the World Faith Development Dialogue, and is a senior fellow at the Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs at Georgetown University. Linda Saussure, a young activist whose fearless advocacy has made her a social media juggernaut and a beautiful thorn in the side of every bigot in power. She is the executive director of Arab American Association of New York and widely respected for her defense of American Muslims. Joyce Dubinsky, a visionary ending religious discrimination in our workplaces, our schools, our health centers, and our communities. A champion of peacemakers of every faith in places of conflict and hurt in our world. Joyce is the CEO of the Tannenbaum Center for Interreligious Understanding here in New York City. And Catherine Henderson, a seminary president who has turned upside down our expectations of what a seminary can do, forging multi-religious engines of justice, research, and leadership development. She's had the shortest trip of anyone here today. She just had to come down the elevator to come to today's meeting. And just like a bad late-night infomercial, I'm going to say to you, but wait, there's more. They will be brought into conversation with us by a person whom all other religious journalists look to as the gold standard in the field, the award-winning national religion correspondent to our beloved New York Times, Lori Goodstein. If you have questions for our panelists today and the moderator, I encourage you to put them on the green cards that are being passed out around the room, and we will collect them during the course of the conversation. We'll collate them and help present them to Lori so she can help facilitate the conversation with our panelists. You can also submit questions via Twitter. We are using the Twitter handle throughout the course of the conference, which I encourage you to tweet about your experiences here, and that's hashtag RCC16NYC. Again, I'll repeat that. Hashtag RCC16NYC. NYC. So tweet away, RCCers. And without further ado, Lori, the stage is yours. Thank you.
Well, I think Dr. Forbes set us up beautifully by asking, what are you going to do about it? Because this panel hopefully is going to, in very concrete ways, address some of what is leading to that, I like that term, the degenerative discouragement disease that seems to be gripping the country. And I just wanted to set the stage a little bit with headlines that just happened, things that just happened in the very last few days to illustrate a little bit about how, can you all hear me? Is it picking up now? Okay. About how we are all connected and how vital these questions of interfaith connections and multi-religious communication is. On Easter Sunday, there was a suicide bomber who walked into a park in Lahore, Pakistan, and managed to kill as many as 72 people, many of them women and children. And the Pakistani Taliban claimed that they intentionally picked Sunday because it was Easter Sunday, and that they wanted to kill as many Christians as possible in that park. However, in doing so, they also killed many, many Muslims, maybe even more Muslims than Christians. We're all connected. Yesterday, at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, what should show up on the campus but graffiti all over the campus saying, stop Islam, and graffiti also, this could give you a hint, saying build the wall, Trump 2016. A team of students has been trying to wash it clean and erase it, and they're actually having trouble doing that. I don't know what kind of chalk they use, but it's something that's quite indelible, which is, to me, very symbolic that they cannot seem to scrub that out of that campus. Pakistan, the other side of the world, Ann Arbor, Michigan. We are all connected. These things all connect. Many individual relationships, the communications we have with one another, the communications we have over social media, we all impact one another like some big, billiard game. And so I've asked the women on the panel, and in case you are wondering, no, we did not coordinate our outfits in advance. As you can tell, because Catherine clearly did not get the message. But we're all connected, right? This is how it happens. But I've asked them to each introduce themselves, both their faith background, in really just in a nutshell, the work they do, again, as concretely as possible, but just so we can set up what it is. There is work already being done. That is why these women are on this panel. They are doing the work. But then in the question and answer, I think I'm going to try, and also with your help, with your questions, to push and challenge them a little bit. We don't want this, and I know that they won't make this about platitudes, interreligious platitudes. We need more than that right now. So anyway, let's begin. I guess let's start, let's just go down the line, is that all right? You want to start, Catherine?
You suggested that we be concrete, but also that we have some stories. And once I get started, I might get carried away, so please stop me when I have... You said 5 minutes, I think. When I went to college a long, long time ago, there was something called Facebook, but it was a different kind of Facebook. It was actually pictures. And under mine, it said that I came from Ibadan, Nigeria. And the reason was that my father had moved to Nigeria right after independence and was working under a Ford Foundation project on public administration training. At that school, and I was at school in England, boarding schools, because people didn't go to school in Nigeria in those days if they had an alternative. There are two things that stood out for me that color my later experience. One was that the Anglican tradition imbued everything in that school. We had two prayers a day, three times on Sunday, Bible studies, etc. So it was, but it was also the music, it was also the art, the theater, everything was very much part of an Anglican world. To a point, when I was confirmed, we used to wear black shoes. It was our uniform that had Cromwell's, that had silver buckles. And they made us polish the soles so that the bishop wouldn't see dirty soles when we knelt for our confirmation. But a second thing that I remember from that was that two of my closest friends were Bertrand Russell's granddaughters, who were aggressive atheists. But they also left me with a very strong sense that ethics and religion are not necessarily tied. And one thing they said their grandfather told them, because they lived with him, was that as you grow older, your life is etched in your face. So you need to be a good person, because otherwise it will be reflected in your face. So from living in Nigeria during the vacations, I came with a passion for the cause of international development, went to graduate school, and eventually tumbled into the World Bank, where I spent 35 years. More than half the World Bank's life, more than half my life, in very operational activities, mostly Africa, Latin America, and East Asia, doing a lot of different things. But in the final years, I was drafted by Jim Wolfensohn, the president, to work on a dialogue he had started with the Archbishop of Canterbury, who you'll meet on Saturday, George Carey, but also the Aga Khan, Prince Talal, Echegaray of the Vatican, to try to deal with the fact that there were two constituencies that cared about social justice, the poor, which were the religious and the development institutions, but at that point they were at each other's throats, literally in demonstrations. And so the idea was to have a dialogue. So that is what I have been doing now since 1999, is a dialogue. So a couple of comments about what that means. First of all, I would argue that the dialogue between the secular and the religious puts a pale on the dialogue among religious traditions. It's a far more difficult and in many ways a more important dialogue. It's one that requires all sorts of leaps of understanding. The second is the extraordinary invisibility of religion in many secular worlds, that it simply was not there. People simply never saw and spoke to, partly because of this alienation. And yet, as we have come to look at what is the significance of religious groups in the development field, there is a religious dimension of every issue from AIDS to zebras, including water, energy access, domestic violence, family planning, you name it. Every issue has a religious dimension, which is not surprising if perhaps 85% of the world's people adhere to a religious tradition. So my job as a professor, as a researcher, as the head of an NGO, sitting on various boards, is to try to communicate, to re-inject a religious literacy that is a thoughtful and objective literacy that allows people to see across these huge divides that have developed in so many parts of the contemporary world.
She's actually keeping time. All right, I'm Joyce Dubinsky. My story starts, I think, with anti-Semitism. When I was 7 or 8, I lived on a dead end, and there were about 8 houses. And my brother and I were the 2 Jewish kids, and everyone else was Catholic or Protestant, and we all played together on the street. One of the games we played was war. And just so happened on one particular day that the war game was my brother and me and everyone else. And that's when they started calling my brother a Jew bastard and screaming that we were Christ killers. My brother was behind me. He was about 4 at the time. And I started saying, you have to apologize. I won't play with you unless you apologize. And they didn't. And I went inside. And that was the summer, really, where I learned what it was like to be totally ostracized and alone, because they never apologized. And I spent that summer on the front porch watching them play in the street together. And we didn't talk with each other. And at the end of the summer, the father of one of the families, he had 5 children, came to my father, and he said, we've got to do something. He said, I am sorry, my wife is a bigot, but we have to do something because our children should play together. And my father agreed, and both of them went home and told us, you're going to play together tomorrow. So you can't hear, sorry about that. And we went, the next day we did play together. I was raised Jewish, and part of my upbringing was pride in Jewish accomplishments, meaning people who were Jewish who accomplished things like Einstein. It was talked about in my home. And part of the undercurrent was that anti-Semitism was lurking. And I had a number of experiences along the way that confirmed that. A best friend who was no longer able to play with me because maybe I'd introduced her to a Jewish boy in high school. A dear boyfriend who was an ex-monk, and we were all real liberals, and who said, you know, if you scratch deep enough, you'll find an anti-Semite. And I'm one of them. And so you would think that that would be the reason I went into interfaith work, but it's not. That didn't move me to working on religion. What it moved me was to work on justice, because what I concluded was that it was really painful, and that what had to happen was that people, no matter what their identity, shared a common humanity or a shared divinity, however one wanted to look at it, and we had to honor the humanity or the divine within each person. And so I was involved in the movements that unfolded, civil rights, women's rights, fighting homophobia, working with ability status issues, et cetera, et cetera. And my career unfolded, and that was always a theme that was part of what I was concerned about. In the 90s, which seemed to be a pivotal time for us, I was head of the diversity task force at UJA Federation, a Jewish organization, which happened to have multi-faith staff, but was serving a Jewish cause. And we had a Martin Luther King Day celebration, and I heard someone speak, and I said, if I could do anything, I'd work with that guy on policy issues. So I wormed my way into his good graces, and a year later he hired me as his national director of marketing and communications, about which I knew nothing. But we were fighting bias, bigotry, and racism at NCCJ. Fast forward, the opportunity at Tannenbaum came up, and I was in job search at that point for a range of reasons, and someone called me and said, this is the job for you. And indeed, it has turned out to be the place I want to be. So what do we do there? Our focus is on combating the spectrum of religious prejudice, disinformation, hatred, violence, extremism. And we do it in two core ways. One, in everyday life, when our different beliefs can cause conflicts, whether it's kids being bullied in school because of their beliefs, whether it's people being harassed or discriminated against in workplaces, in healthcare because they're not getting proper care because no one's asking the right questions about how they make decisions. And internationally, with people who are using religion or are driven by faith to try to work for peace. You'd asked, why do we still do it? And for me, there are two reasons. One is because I really believe that of all the ways we may identify ourselves, maybe the hardest to get right is how do we live together across our many different ways of believing? And how do we practice respect in real terms? So it's the issue I want to be tackling, and I'm proud to be doing it. And I also do it because when I think of the sick child who's walking down the street and is mugged by his colleagues and his turban is ripped off, I remember what it's like to sit on that porch, and I don't want anyone to feel the way I did.
Linda?
Good afternoon, everyone. So my name is Linda Sarsour. I am a born and bred and work and breathe everything Brooklyn, New York. I am a daughter of Palestinian Muslim immigrants who came here to the United States of America from living under military occupation in the 1970s. For me, I think you probably all know, I'm in a situation, and I'm going to speak in a communications frames, where my community has only two stories that are being told. We're either the victims of violence, or we're the perpetrators of violence. And that there's a huge story in between that's not being told, and that's where I come in. There's a huge story of contributions to the United States of America, of social justice activism, of movement work, of inventors, of professionals, of workers, of students, of feminists. That's just not, that we just don't exist according to the media. And I think it's not that there's more violence in the world that's being perpetrated by Muslims. It just happens to be that that's what brings up the ratings, and that is where people want to focus, especially when the perpetrators of violence are Muslim and the victims of the violence are not Muslim. That's when the story is really hot. And what moves me in my faith is beyond this idea that, you know, the Abrahamic faiths are religions of peace. I don't know if we're adding anything to the conversation. I don't know if that's what moves me about my faith. What moves me about my faith is that it's a religion of social justice and has always been a religion of social justice. And 1,400 years before the civil rights movement, in my own faith, I had a racial justice activist, a human rights activist, a feminist in his own right, and that was my dear Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And when we learn of the stories of our Prophet and understand that Islam was a religion that brought people, and you know, 2016, that Muslims are people of every ethnic and racial background. We represent every corner of this world. Chinese Muslims, you can find Muslims in Australia. They're black, we're Asian, we're Arab, we're converts. I mean, we are one of the largest, if not the fastest growing religion in the world right now. And for me, this idea of Islamophobia is not really a new concept. We just in this country, we just keep naming things new things. Like, we just come up with these new terms and we want to make it seem like it's a new revelation to everyone else. But for me, I come from a faith where my Prophet himself was a victim of Islamophobia. He was beaten and assaulted, and people threw garbage at him. And the inspiration that I get is that if my Prophet went through that, and somehow, some way, through all of that, he moved forward, and with his compassion and his love for justice and the poor and those who are marginalized, he was able to convert millions of Muslims at that time. Why am I sitting back acting like I'm some sort of victim? So for me, my work around interfaith has been very important for me to be able to understand the traditions of justice in other communities. I am interested in other things that people believe in, but I want to know what your religion says about equality, about the sanctity of life. Like, that's what I'm interested in. But beyond that, I also don't just do dialogue. Like, for me personally, like, my preference is I want to do work. I don't want to just talk theology. I don't want to be theoretical. I don't want to read text and go home. I want to know what your religion says about justice, and let's go out into the streets and implement what our faith say about justice. And that's what I am. I'm a social justice faith activist. My faith moves me to be with those who are most directly impacted by the issues that I care about. Racial injustice, poverty, immigrant rights, workers' rights. Those are my issues. And the people that are the most directly impacted by these issues need to be at the forefront of those. And I think what's really important also about being someone who comes from a community who is directly impacted by the issues that I care about, and understanding where my spirituality kind of comes into that. My spirituality is manifested in my activism work, right? If for me, and this is my own personal view on religion, if religion for you is praying to God and that's all you do, then you're just having a conversation and no one's listening. For me, prayer has to be not just something private, but prayer has to be manifested in the way that you help and uplift others around you. And I also believe that in my activism work, that one day, and for those who believe in God, I believe in the day of judgment, and I believe that I'm going to be asked, what was I doing? What did I do? Did I walk by injustice when I saw it? Did I sit back and say, nope, they're not Muslim, can't get down with those people? The idea that my work is what has attracted many young people in my community to this idea of faith. There are people in my community that don't want to go to the mosque because their mosque is irrelevant to them. That they pray on Friday and the priests, the imams, excuse me, may not be telling people this is your chance. Your religion gives you the tools and the resources to go out and fight against injustice and to show compassion and love to other people. I'm very proud to be a Muslim. I am more unapologetically Muslim today than I was 15 years ago. And I want people to know that this is something that is, we are trying to encourage and motivate our community, because our community right now overall is probably not unapologetically Muslim. It's very hard to be a Muslim right now in this country. And I think for me, being able to be, you know, I'm a senior fellow at Auburn Seminary, and I'm not just sitting around and talking about religion. I'm strategizing about being part of a faith movement, about doing faith-rooted justice and organizing, about where the faith community needs to be at this time. And I agree with Reverend Forbes, like, what are we doing? And for me, I think the most challenging thing has been, for me, is that this idea that, like, Donald Trump created racism in our country, and hearing faith people, you know, talk about Donald Trump as, like, the evil, you know, that, I don't know, like, the evil that we've been, like, avoiding or something. I mean, this evil that is Donald Trump has always existed in our country. Racism has always existed in our country. Anti-Semitism has always been here. Islamophobia has been on the shores of these nations. So this idea that some guy is representing something that already existed here, and all of a sudden we feel moved. I question our faith and humanity that we have not been moved by these very injustices that have continued to occur for centuries in our country. And I think the moral compass of our country lays in communities of faith and those who are the communicators that are putting out the messages to the people. And if we're not connecting faith to social activism and uplifting those in our country who are the most marginalized, who are at the bottom, then I really question why and what faith, and if we are following faith in the right way. So I'm very honored to be on the stage with these wonderful women, and I say to you that my work in interfaith has been challenging, and I'll talk about what my challenges are later, but I will say from an individual place, from a personal place, that my faith has moved me. And so when you see me out in these streets, it's not because I have I'm somebody extraordinary or because I have all this passion and energy. I believe wholeheartedly that it is my obligation, that my faith calls me to be at the forefront of social justice movements for all people, because one thing that's so beautiful about Islam and our Prophet, peace be upon him, is that justice in Islam was never just us. It was never just about Muslims. And when our Prophet was on this earth, he uplifted all people, even those people who were his opposition. And that is the type of people we need to be, making sure that we're not only upset when things happen to our own communities, but that we are just as outraged when innocent people are killed, regardless of what communities they are from, or communities that are attacked, regardless of what faith or ethnicity or sexual orientation or all the other labels that people are giving our communities. So I hope we can talk about that and what that looks like and what the messages that we need to be putting out there are.
So I can trace everything that I'm doing today at Auburn Seminary and working with people like the women at this table, including Linda here. We are happy to have her as our senior fellow, one of our senior fellows at Auburn. I can trace all of this work today back to my childhood. I grew up in Louisville, Kentucky. My father taught Hebrew scriptures and Hebrew in a Presbyterian seminary. And our closest neighbors next door were Max and Ruth Goldberg, who didn't have any children of their own, and so they were second parents to me. I was the child that they never had. They loved me. They loved us fiercely, and we loved them fiercely. Our lives were completely intertwined with each other. Their recipes became our recipes. We shared food. We shared faith. And we shared daily life. At the same time, my father, who traveled in the Middle East in the 1950s and was already at that time deeply concerned about Israeli-Palestinian issues, and often around our table were missionaries from Tehran and from Lebanon, and they would come and bring stories of the Muslim neighbors and Arab Christians and the love of the countries that they found in those Arab lands. And so my home was in some ways an interfaith home.
It was the food that we ate, this living and breathing with other people. At the same time, my parents had grown up in the segregated South in North Carolina and had been deeply affected. I had a Quaker grandfather who fought the Klan and was harassed physically for that. And so that was the legacy of racism that my parents brought with them to Louisville. And so as a child, we marched in civil rights marches. They did not, I didn't know what it meant exactly. All I knew was that I was in this crowd of people. We were doing something important. We were marching together, and we ended up in a church singing hymns afterwards. We looked different. We didn't always associate together, but I knew that we were doing something of deep significance together. And so my work today, so that this idea of faith, that your faith is not something that is sitting in a pew or simply praying, but your faith takes you out into the streets. It takes you and mixes you up with other people. It means that you're putting your faith into action. And, you know, I love the Heschel quote, our feet were praying, and that's what I was taught as a child, that our feet have to pray. So fast forward here, I have the privilege, I mean, I see this discouragement that Jim spoke about, but I am so completely excited and encouraged because the work that I do at Auburn is to figure out, with a lot of other help from colleagues, what does it mean to be a religious leader today, and how do you equip leaders of faith and moral courage today to take on this sometimes discouraging world? And so we do this. We equip leaders. Auburn's work, Auburn's almost 200 years ago, we were founded as a Presbyterian seminary. Today we are more of a multi-faith seminary with Christian roots. Our work as a leadership development and research institute is to equip leaders to do the work of justice. And so we do that with leaders nationally and internationally. We work with Christians, Jews, Muslims, Sikhs, humanists. You can find us in the Gurdwara in Oak Creek, where people were shot at worship. You can find us in Charleston, where people were shot while at Bible study. You can find us online. We have a digital platform called Groundswell, where over 200,000 people across the country take action on lots of different issues like Islamophobia. You can find us online. You can find us in real time. And we train people through media training, through action, digital engagement, and through research. And so our motto is trouble the waters, heal the world, which means you have to stir things up and make some trouble to actually heal the world. So that's my work, and happy to be here with all of you today.
Well, this is just what I hope, that this would kind of set the stage so you know who is sitting in front of you and what their stories are a little bit and how they came to be here. But what I want to get to is to bring us up now to date and in very specific ways. I want to start more on the kind of hopeful side. We'll get to some of the, some of the things that make this work difficult, but I wanted to begin by asking each of you for a brief story about work that has been successful, interfaith work that you think you or your organization set out to do that that succeeded, and what you take away from that. If there's some larger takeaway, so who wants to start with that?
I got a phone call. We work in global, workplaces, and I got a phone call from a company you would all know, who shall not be named. And the question was, we have these Muslims that are in the bathroom and they're washing their feet, and I'm getting complaints. Can I tell them to stop? And because our focus at Tannenbaum is around helping companies understand that that's not per se a problem, but an opportunity to encourage your staff both to learn about one another, practice respect, and work together, we sought to problem solve with them, so ask them a couple of questions. How many bathrooms do you have? Well, they had multiple floors and multiple bathrooms. Could you segregate one and even create a room near it that could be a quiet room where after cleaning themselves for prayer, because this is a practice that some Muslims partake in before prayer, they could go. And a quiet room, not a prayer room, because it should be a place where everyone would be welcome, including those who would want to reflect and might not self-identify as religious. He said, yeah, we've got that, we could do that. And I said, okay, well, that sounds like a solution to this. And then it was like, but we have, you know, a bigger problem. I'm really afraid they're going to, like, fall when they wash their feet, and they're going to get hurt, and we're going to be liable. So it was like, how about creating a space where they can put their shoes in this bathroom and have foot basins where they can wash? You know, oh, we can do that. And then we work with them on the communications to all their colleagues. And we said, you know, how about something like, we respect and honor the beliefs of all of our colleagues, and to the greatest extent possible, we want to accommodate all of you. This is how we are accommodating some of our Muslim colleagues who wish to do this. This bathroom, designated here, is open for this purpose. Anyone can use it, but if you would prefer not to use it, there are 9 other bathrooms. So now you know the policy and why we're doing it, and please feel free to use the quiet room because it's open to all of you. So that was a solution, the bigger in the moment. The bigger piece of that is that that work and that program, which started in the late 90s with data that showed that many people in workplaces experience religious bias or perceive to have experienced religious bias, we had a long haul convincing people that that was a real issue. Today we have a corporate membership program, and in a 4-year period, we went from 5 to 25 global corporations, including Disney, Depository Trust Company, Allstate, Citigroup, Merck, and Walmart, among others. And they come to us and work with us around their policies, how they train their management, and how they adopt what we call at Tannenbaum the accommodation mindset. They have millions of employees around the world. To the extent they change how they practice within their companies, they maximize talent and they become an employer of choice. So the lesson learned from all of that, twofold. Keep going, because it's very hard. You have to make people understand sometimes the need for the work, and talk in the language that they understand. Because for businesses, businesses are in business to do business. They're not in business to do what I might consider just. But when they do what I consider just, it just so happens that there's data that it inures to the bottom line, that they have higher retention, that they may be able to attract better talent, and that they may become the employer of choice and have greater business success. So there's a reason to do it, and it's their reason. Thank you.
You're looking for the positive story, but I want to start with the fact that the idea of an engagement between the worlds of religion and the worlds of development and ending poverty, humanitarian, etc., was a very hard sell. And at one point, Jim Wolfensohn said it was 184 countries to zero in favor of doing this. So one of the early areas that we focused on was the area of health, where there is such a long tradition of religious engagement on health. We realized at first that the estimates of exactly what that means are very difficult to come to in any specific terms. The estimates in Africa of what percentage of the healthcare system is provided by religious institutions ranges from 7 to 70%, 7 to 70, which shows you the areas of question and the uncertainties around this. But the story of hope that I want to focus on is the story of HIV/AIDS. And it was an area where one of the reasons for this opposition was the sense that religious institutions were against progress. They were against development. They were against women. They were against so many of the fundamental changes of modernization. And indeed, in the early years of the HIV/AIDS crisis, there were pastors who railed about sin, who refused to bury people who had died in the churchyard. There were terrible stories. There was a tremendous tension. But at the same time, the people who were caring in communities, and I'm talking mainly about Africa, though there's a parallel story in the United States, who were taking care of orphans, who were recognizing the cause of orphans, who were fighting for equality in access to the medications, expensive as they were as they became available, were often the religious organizations. And to me, the key message of hope that comes from this is the process of transformation that I have witnessed, that I've been part of, seeing so many changes in people, people willing to admit that they were wrong, seeing different parts of this story, seeing, bringing out the caring and the compassion, the willingness to appreciate experiences that others have gone through. So Canon Gideon Byamugisha, for example, is a Ugandan Anglican priest, one of the first priests who came public, who went public admitting that he was HIV positive. I have seen the impact that he has as a religious leader in speaking honestly about what this stigma does, what the discrimination, the need to get away from, for example, the ABC method, which he sees as highly discriminatory, that either you're abstinent, you're faithful, and then as a sort of distant third, you might use a condom. He has a very different formula, which is much more based on a subtle and a thoughtful, theologically driven understanding of what it means. And there are many others like him in an organization called INIRELA, which is religious leaders who are affected by and living with HIV/AIDS, that I think has among the most powerful influence of any organization working in this area. And it has helped over the years to open people's eyes and hearts and minds to what the challenges are, the complexity of the ethical issues that are involved, and really to bring about what is today a fundamentally different approach to those issues in communities in many parts of the world. We have a long way to go, but it is a story, I think, of great hope.
Want another story of
hope? Okay. Sure.
Okay. So I think for a lot of us, and you all are communicators, we're trying to figure out how to capture the attention of the media in a more positive way. How do you, instead of working in the frames that have been set for us, how do you try to shift the frame? And so one of the ways we did that, I'm thinking right now about the climate change march here in New York City. And we tried to figure out with some of our colleagues how religious folks, how Christians, Jews, Muslims, and others could show up together in that march. And so we ended up building an ark, a wooden ark on a flatbed truck, that a 28-foot long ark that led the religious folks in that climate change march. What we were trying to do, we call it an ethical spectacle, at Auburn and the Lingo, which is trying to create a different kind of visual image, a different kind of image that would be picked up in the media, that would tell a story. And the story that we told was that there was every kind of animal on that ark. There were animals, Christians, Jews, Muslims, Sikhs, and others. The humanist chaplain, Greg Epstein at Harvard, decided that he wanted to ride on the ark with the religious folks, and he held a sign down as we rolled along off the side that said, an atheist on the ark. And so there were a lot of people in the crowd who nodded knowingly, a lot of those N-O-N-E-S kind of folks probably, who actually were amused and that you had the humanist chaplain there, the atheist on the ark. We passed out animal crackers, packages to the crowds going by. And everybody, when we stood still before we started rolling along, everybody wanted to get up on that ark. People wanted to get up. They wanted to see the view from the ark. One of the most meaningful visuals that I have in my mind, a meme, is that it was time for Muslim prayer before we got rolling. And so the Muslim group right next to us put their prayer rugs down on 59th Street, right there on the street, and the rest of us, other religious leaders, other religious folks, formed a circle of kind of protection and safety, a sanctuary, if you will, around that Muslim group to allow them a safe and somewhat protected prayer space. I think this is the example of, as Paul Netter, theologian, would say, the peoples of the world call us to stop fighting with each other and to find ways to work together across lines of religious difference. In this case, it was around climate change.
Well, congratulations, because you managed to answer three questions that we had. and I'll tell you retrospectively what they are, because maybe we can keep this in mind on the panel, but they're good questions. I mean, one is media ratings on hatred and violence seem to rule these days. How do we religion communicators compete? I think that's a really good question for us to keep in mind throughout the panel. There was another question about environmental activism, and another question about why are atheists so despised by religious people, and can the interfaith community kind of work together with the non-faith community? So, good going. Okay, so Linda, do you have a story you want to tell, or you want to move on to the next?
I mean, I'll just so that I'm not the Muslim that would be like the hopeless Muslim, I'll just give up. I mean, a quick story, and I think something that reminds me of why we do the work that we do and kind of how we do it in New York is last year on March 4th, I had the pleasure of standing next to the mayor of New York City to announce the incorporation of Muslim school holidays in the New York City public school calendar. And what was beautiful about that campaign was it was very simple. 13% of the public school population are Muslim kids, which means one out of every eight students are Muslim. Asking for recognition, inclusion, and respect, so it wasn't asking the city for any favors. And what was beautiful about it is that the religious communities of New York City stood up. So it was Muslims asking, but the Christian community, the Jewish community, the Sikh community, all types of religious communities, including labor, which that is not a religious community, but made up of people who come from our communities, who stood up and said, we believe in this cause, we believe that Muslim students deserve recognition, inclusion, and respect in the New York City public school system. And we made that campaign happen. We're the largest public school system in the entire country that recognizes Muslim holidays. We're talking about 1.2 million students and a wonderful educational opportunity about why are you home from school today? There's a Muslim holiday. So that was a big win, and it required communities across New York City to join together and to stand behind the Muslim community unapologetically. And when we do that, we get to prove that we can win really big campaigns.
Okay, good. Yeah, I think this is pretty inspiring, and I wanted to start with the kind of what worked, partly to fight that degenerative discouragement disease, but also partly to provide examples of that activism actually is accomplishing something. I see it, I see the movement, I see the change, and sometimes when you think things are going to explode in a community that had a kind of religiously based trauma, and they don't. I think partly what explains that is the work that that these women and people like this across the country are doing in interfaith work. However, there's a long way to go, And I do want us to get to kind of what the obstacles are. Maybe even in, it could either be in the examples you just gave us or in something else, but what made it hard, or what made it almost not work out, or what kind of misunderstanding was there, maybe one faith about the other, that you could share with us and, you know, help us kind of be able to foresee those things instead of running just headlong into them. So who wants to start with that?
I mean, I'll just sort of pick up on where I was on the arc. I mean, I think the question that someone raised is a very interesting one about the place of atheists and humanists in the interfaith movement. I mean, I and we at Auburn and lots of others we're a big tent sort of place, and we believe in a radically inclusive movement, you know, whoever will join with us. Partly it's because we see that people can actually change. There are people who make vast personal and community transformations. I mean, that's possible. If I didn't believe in that, I wouldn't be doing this work. But I think, you know, who we were willing to welcome to the table, we didn't say to Greg, oh, sorry, you're not a faith leader. You can't get on the ark. So it became, a bigger table. And I think that we are still at a place often where interfaith tables are not really as radically inclusive, including Muslims and Sikhs, as they could be. And so I think we have to keep continually pressing. I think it's also the fault lines are not so much between religious traditions, but between extremist or more extreme and conservative forms of religious traditions that often have more in common than those of us who are willing to be at the table together and work together on a lot of issues.
Have you gotten pushback as, you know, leading a seminary that, you know, is identified as Presbyterian? Have you gotten pushback from people who say, why are you working with these humanists? Why are you welcoming these atheists that has no place in a seminary?
I think, no. I mean, maybe strangely to your hearing, but not. And I think it's because, you know, we have set the tone for the kind of place that we're going to be in, the kind of movement and possibility for working together that we see.
Joyce?
I want to speak about the non-believers who don't identify as having a religion first. We recently did a national survey of the American worker, a follow-up to what we had done in the 90s. I keep having the feeling you're not hearing me. At any rate, we did a survey of the American worker, and what we found was that although 1 in 3 American workers have personally experienced religious bias or have witnessed it happening to someone else, there were 3 groups that disproportionately stood out. One was who you would expect, people from minority religious traditions in this country, meaning by population. Second was the atheists and the non-believers, who disproportionately felt that they were on the receiving end of proselytizing or discussions about religion. And third were white evangelical Protestants who also feel it. So our work tries to embrace all of those different ways of believing, and in fact at Tannenbaum, for the last 5 years, a chairman of my board who was an evangelical Christian, and we did not agree on everything. We see things differently, and we both learned from each other. And he really broadened my capacity, because I probably fall into that progressive liberal group, but he broadened my capacity to understand bias and to see even where I had my own blind spots. And so, very quick story on that. You may remember the shooting at the Family Resource Council. And I think, as I recollect, someone went in and said, I'm shooting at you because of your politics. I don't like your politics. And so I didn't say anything as an organization about that. And I heard from my chairman saying, and where are you? And I said, this is political. It's not about religion. And he said, I think you're missing the point. And I had to learn more, and indeed he was right, and we needed to speak out. And so I think that there's room, if you will, at the table, in the tent, within this work, for all of our different ways of believing, and we have to look for the best ways to balance our differences so that we treat each other with respect.
I spend 6 to 9 months dealing with the flood of objections that came up from the international community that were members of the World Bank to the idea of engaging with religion. And amidst this extraordinary web of different comments, I've pulled out basically three D's and an E. The first D is the perception that religion is basically divisive. And in many cases, that comes down to politics. So it is. It relates to the questioning of motivations, that it's really about proselytizing, it's really about money, it's really about some kind of exclusive. So just a whole sea of prejudices that, in a sense, come around the sense of divisive. The second D is that religion is basically dangerous, that it is against modernization. It believes the poor shall always be with us, that there's a virtue in poverty. Obviously, and I think we'll come back on this for sort of visual reasons here, the problems with women, the sense that women, that religious groups are instinctively and deeply patriarchal and basically against women's rights, women's equality. The third D is the assumption that with modernization, religion becomes less important, that it's basically defunct, that it deserves a low priority, that amidst all of the issues that we have to deal with, why would you deal with this one? So those were sort of the three Ds that came up again and again. And then an E is what I call emotional. And interestingly, it parallels a lot of the way people deal with gender issues, that they approach them with their emotions, not necessarily with their brains. And so you tend to have discussions that are very much around what I believe. And I've come to a point where I say, I don't care what you believe. What's important is what the people we're trying to help believe. That's the driver. And the upshot of this is an enormous amount of missed opportunities, whether it's to address maternal mortality, domestic violence, whether it's to deal with malaria, tuberculosis, to deal with getting clean water, with the embarrassing problem of open defecation, with female genital cutting, with just a host of problems that deserve to be at the forefront where we need partnerships. It is these misunderstandings that have stopped the partnerships that really take us to scale and have us working together. So there are a host of activities and individual activities, but the sense of common purpose, of a common drive, is perhaps emerging, but it is still far from universal.
So I just wanted to provide three challenges, I think, to working amongst religious communities and in particular some religious leadership. And in this country, what we've seen is that a lot of the religious structure is connected to the political structure. So there's a lot of respectability politics amongst clergy when it comes to issues that we're trying to push forward. Sometimes there are religious leadership that have more allegiance to power and access to power than they have to the people and the congregants in their houses of worship or even in the communities in which they serve. So that sometimes is seen as a challenge, which is why oftentimes many people who are social justice activists don't want to work with the religious leadership, or you might not see that synergy that you think should exist or should be natural but is not. So that's a big issue that we have, and especially in a place like New York, there are very limited religious clergy who are willing to stand up unequivocally and from a place of, you know, of and have the moral courage to speak out on issues because they're afraid that maybe their affordable housing project won't get money or something like that. Like, there's just some really issues around respectability politics and access to power and things like that. So that's one issue. The other challenges is a lot of, you know, kind of dialogue or interfaith dialogue that doesn't lead to action. So we meet like once a month, and that's awesome, and I love that. But I really want to figure out, like, what can we do together? Like, how can we make our communities better? I think you knowing how many times a day I pray is not, I don't know how helpful that is to the people in New York City or to those that are in poverty. So I appreciate that you want to learn about me. But my question is, how can my tradition and your tradition join together so we can uplift those in our communities who are the least fortunate? And the third one, and I'll say this from a personal perspective, and this is a challenge I've had for many years, and many in my community have this challenge, is that sometimes interfaith work comes with litmus tests. Like, for example, there are certain people in New York City that won't work with people like me. I'm Palestinian. I can't, what am I supposed to do about that? Like, I can't be like, I'm not going to be Palestinian for these 3 hours that we're together. So this idea that the virtue of who I am and the identity that I bring and the family and the stories that I bring of being a child of immigrants who lived under military occupation in Palestine, family who was impacted by Israeli policies on the people that are my grandmother who lives there, my cousins who live there, somehow that's not welcomed into interfaith spaces, that I'm not allowed to bring that story and that part of me there. And I've been in a place like New York City, and many of you know, many times have been called an anti-Semite. And I've never said anything anti-Semitic. I've been a critic of the Israeli government. I think I should be able to be that and not have that conflated with being an anti-Semite. I think all people should be critics of the Israeli government and their occupation of Palestinian people and the way that in which the Palestinian people are being treated. And I think we do the same thing here in this country. We would say the same thing about a community in South America or Central America or another part of the world. So that's been a challenge for Muslims, especially in where they say, I don't know if this is true, and Joyce can tell me, something about there are mainstream Jewish organizations in New York City. And we don't know what that means. I don't know what a mainstream Jew is. And I don't know how progressive Jews that I'm organizing with supposedly are not mainstream Jews. Like, I've been told that, and people have blogged about this, that the Jews that I work with, like Jewish Voice for Peace types or Jews Against Islamophobia in New York City, you know, people who are proud of their Jewish heritage, people who stand up for justice and use the traditions of their faith to stand up for all people, including Black people and undocumented, somehow, according to, quote, I don't know who the mainstream Jews are, and particularly conservative Jewish media and bloggers, somehow those Jews are not mainstream. So it puts me in a conundrum as a Muslim that somehow I'm not working with the right Jews or I'm not working with the right Christians. And I don't know what that means. I don't know how I'm supposed to decipher that. But the challenge really has been that we don't have inroads in the, quote, mainstream Jewish community. I'm going to be honest with you. We don't have it. And I think that the issue of Israel-Palestine in particular has been a challenge to doing meaningful interfaith work and really interfaith social justice work in New York. I'm not about to solve the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. I mean, it's been around for a pretty long time. But the fact that I can't sit at a table or have a meaningful opportunity to do social justice work here because I'm Palestinian or because I have a particular political view, it is why we find ourselves in these situations that we're in. We allow these litmus tests to occur, and people in the movement are not saying. And it's the same thing in the Black Lives Matter movement. Some Jews are saying there's no space for us there. We're not at those tables. We're not in those movements because the Black Lives Matter activists are saying justice for Palestine, Palestinian liberation. So God forbid anybody calls for the liberation of Palestinian people. So I think that for me has been a conundrum that I've been dealing with for 16 years in New York City. And I think that there could be a way around it. I just don't know what that is. So maybe the real, no, I'm just kidding. I was going to say the real Jews raise their hands so I know who you are. But that's what I've been told, and I'm sure that that's not true.
I disclaim the ability to speak for the mainstream Jewish community. But I actually think there's a key point in even in the idea that there is such a thing. And that I think one of the things that behooves all of us is that you can know that I'm Jewish. I happen to be sitting here and talking with you about the fact that I am, although I actually represent an organization that is secular, does not promote religion, and does not denigrate it. Our focus is on the power of religion. But we tend to think of each other as representatives of different communities, to your point. And you don't know if I am kosher. You don't know if I observe the Sabbath. You don't know if I rush out of the office on Yom Kippur and it's the only time during the year that I'm thinking I better get home in time so I can get to temple. You don't know. You'd have to ask me. And so I think part of it is learning to ask the questions and talk with each other. And we can have further conversations on what you just raised. I'm happy to, but not as a representative of anybody but myself.
Yeah, I think that I have certainly experienced, having done this work over two decades now in the city and across the country, I mean, I do think that often the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is the thing that's in the room that often people are most afraid to address, and that it does impede the ability to do work on a lot of other justice issues together. And back to dialogue, you know, dialogue isn't sufficient, but so many people don't really know how to have the hard conversations with each other that will move them to a different place. And I think that that's one of the things that, you know, that is a part of all of our work here. How do you actually stay at a table in a room with people with whom you may disagree? And, you know, that's one of the biggest issues in our country now that is polarized around so many different issues.
Yeah, and I'm really glad that that it came up, because I think that if we had a panel like this and it didn't come up, we would be part of the problem. So I think by calling it to your attention and getting people to think about, you know, when is it relevant, when is it not? Is it relevant in a Black Lives Matter protest? You know, what people call or think, you know, the West Bank and Gaza, you know, what they name it, where they're from. So anyway, I also don't want the panel to get just hung up on that, but I think that's one of the really good takeaways from this panel here that was brought up. There's so many good questions here, and we're definitely not going to get to all of them, but I want to acknowledge that that people are asking good questions. I might be able to boil down a little bit of what I'm picking up here. You know, Linda mentioned in her introduction that it is not as though Donald Trump introduced bigotry and racism to this country, and yet this is something that is on everybody's minds. And one of the questioners asks, you know, why is it that you know, the movement for interfaith cooperation is not on par with other movements like those, you know, the women's rights movement, environmental movement, the civil rights movement? Is it that the movement is too young or too underfunded? Is there something that should be done to, you know, to elevate the visibility and the impact of this movement? It wasn't a question you had in advance, but I thought it was a good one.
I think that part of the complexity and part of the promise of this particular movement is that we are not focused, we are not issue specific, and we are a multi-faith movement. We're multi-faith movements for justice, and which means that there's a recognition of the intersectionality of an interrelatedness of so many different issues that have been historically pulled apart, so that you can't talk about immigration without talking about Black Lives Matter, without talking about gun violence and other issues. I mean, all of these things are connected in a way that I think that we're only beginning to understand. And what that means in a positive way is that you can leverage people who have been single-issue people around other issues, which is what we try to do in our digital campaign work through Groundswell. So I think it is this, and Laurie, I'm so excited that you are actually seeing this movement, that you, from your perch, can actually see that there is something growing here. And yes, I do think it's young. 10 years ago, we were not thinking about multi-faith movements for justice. We weren't naming things in this way. So this is something new.
I think part of the issue does come back to first, the religious illiteracy, the fact that religion, religious beliefs, tensions, passions, etc., were in many circles off the agenda for a long time, out of the education system. So for many people, they don't have the vocabulary. I think a second issue is that interfaith is partly about harnessing the energies and looking to the common values that are shared so that there can be a joint common effort to address the environment or poverty or hunger or any of the other ills in the society. But it is also about dealing with issues and problems within and among. And surely that, I think, explains in part why there isn't a single groundswell, but so many different pieces of what it's about.
I think there may also be a technical and legal component. The environmental movement and other movements often have advocacy organizations that are legally allowed to take lobbying positions and to take positions on political issues. Nonprofits who are 501c3s are allowed to lobby to some extent within certain constraints. They are not legally allowed to take positions for or against anyone who's a candidate. And so that there are constraints in the work that one may want to do and how you do it. And I think that is yet another hindrance. And then to the other part of your question, underfunded and yes. Overwhelmed, absolutely.
I only have one quick thing. I think every movement is underfunded and overwhelmed, and definitely those that are most directly impacted. I think the opportunity here is not to create a new movement, and I think one of the things that we've been doing as Auburn Seminary Fellows and those that we're connected to is this idea of integrating the social justice faith leaders into the work that's already happening. There's no reason for faith leaders to be standing on another street corner saying we're people of God and we want black, you know, we want police to stop killing black people. The idea is for those religious leaders to bear witness to the social justice movements that are being led by those that are most directly impacted that may not be people screaming God. So, for example, in a place like Ferguson, when you have military apparatus throwing tear gas, there should be clergy standing out there and saying, not on my watch, not to these children of God, right? And that the idea of having religious leaders be part of what is already happening. The movement's out there. They're on the streets. They're lobbying. They're in Washington, D.C. They're shutting Trump down. They're not waiting for the religious communities to come out of there. But what I'm seeing is more religious leaders integrating in the larger apparatus of the social justice movement. And that should be our role. I think creating something new is not what we're trying to do. At least I'm not trying to do that. I want to be where the people are. And if that means that we're amongst humanists and amongst people that may be discouraged by God or think that God is what put them where they are, then that's cool. But we need to figure out how to support the existing infrastructure of the movements that are happening right now.
Coming off of that, I mean, we're in a moment now where bigotry against Muslims and Sikhs in particular is really exploding. I mean, I've seen this kind of come and go over time, and I know you said that too often when Muslims are in the news, it's either as perpetrators or victims. And yet, that is very real. I mean, from what I see coming in over the transom, I mean, it's almost daily. I mean, I mentioned this graffiti at the University of Michigan just because it happened yesterday, but I mean, so many horrible, horrible things are happening. I mean, people being beaten, a sick man in Fresno run over, beaten and then run over, by a car. It's exploding in a way, and in some ways it's reflected in and also perhaps, caused by the coarsening of the dialogue that we've had in the presidential race. So given that is, I mean, I understand what you're saying, that the strategy or the approach is to not be explicitly a religious or interfaith movement, but for those things to infuse the social justice movements that are going on already. However, this issue, this social problem really is explicitly on its own a matter of you know, a matter of religious bigotry. So is there anything that in this moment that you think, you know, faith leaders and people of faith should be doing to address that? You know, what are you thinking as you see these things going on?
So I'll just share with you and just to give folks perspective. And I think the most important thing for me as an American Muslim is for people not to separate Islamophobia into or make it one thing. So Islamophobia for people most often is the individual zealot who's on the street and then like attacks a woman, and that's what we think about Islamophobia. And I think that's absolutely concerning to me, that women in my community who look like me fear to go like in the train station by themselves or don't want to stand too close to the train platform or the vandalisms of our mosques or all these other things that you're hearing. Super problematic. And we should be outraged and say that should never happen to Muslims or Sikhs or any other community. So that's one thing. But not to disconnect that from government policies that continue to target Muslim communities in a post-9/11 America. So when you hear Donald Trump say or Ted Cruz say, we want to, you know, surveil or monitor Muslim communities or do patrolling, and people are like outraged, and there's like every media outlet is like running headlines on it. I'm like, where have you been for 15 years? We've been under unwarranted surveillance in New York City. We have secret documents from the New York Police Department that show us that they were engaging in unwarranted surveillance of cafes, bookstores, organizations like mine that are social service organizations. So that's one thing. You know, bloated no-fly lists, people who are no-fly lists. We're talking about a separate justice system in this country where Muslims can be convicted on secret evidence. They can be languishing in solitary confinement not in Guantanamo, in Indiana. Like, there are things happening here. People were outraged when they heard this notion that, you know, Muslims should register with the government. Like, how dare we go back to the days of Nazi Germany? I'm like, where were you in 2003 when Muslim males were asked to register with what was called then the INS? And of the 880,000 Muslim men who did go and comply with that program, 10% were put on deportation proceedings. Right now, as we speak today, 160 Muslim men, Bangladeshi men, languishing in immigration detention centers are being rounded up and saying, all 160 of you are going to be get sent back to Bangladesh, although they're all asylum seekers and we're basically deporting them to death. So my point is I want people to connect the dots, that the government policies, what they do is they actually reaffirm or the bigotry that happens on the streets with the people. If the government is treating the people this way, then why shouldn't Joe Schmo attack a Muslim woman on the street? Like, we are setting the precedent for people to be allowed to do this. Yes, Donald Trump and all this political conversation adds to that and it fuels that, but we get to this place because we stay silent on all these things for so long, and then all of a sudden it becomes a revelation to everyone when in fact these communities have been under these policies for so long. But there are a lot of things this community needs a moral pickup, you know, for people to send them a message and say, you are here, we see you, you know, we got you. I mean, people think those things are simple. And one of the recent things was when Groundswell, which is this online platform that engages people of all faiths, did like a Muslim love letter and went and delivered it to Muslim organizations. I mean, people think that, you know, might not be, but it's a big deal when you know, 100,000 people, 5,000 people say, we got you, we see you, we're here for you. When we hear armed militia are coming to stand in front of our mosques with guns, and other people of faith say, nope, not on our watch, we are going there to protect worshipers as they go to worship freely in this country, we're going to go stand there and willing to take the risk to do that. This is about sacrifice. It's about, what are you willing to do for me so I can do for you? And it's also about asking yourself a question. And I ask myself this question all the time. I want to know who lived here at the time of Japanese internment camps. Who were those people that allowed that to happen around us? Me personally, as a person of faith, I would never allow that to happen to any other community. If that means I had to risk my life for fellow Japanese Americans, then that's what I would have done. And I'm sure there were people that did that at that time, but they must have not been enough. So the question is, are we going to be enough? Because I think the worst is yet to come. And for people that don't believe that Donald Trump will be the next president, he probably won't. But you better believe that those Donald Trump supporters are not going to take a loss lying down. And we have to be prepared now and not wait till after November to think about, oh my God, what are we going to do moving forward?
Well, I feel in some ways like we're just getting going here, but we do have to stop. But I had the thought that maybe instead of putting a hard stop on this, every one of you is on social media, I think, in some way, or maybe not. Maybe it's a website.
That's fine. A website is fine. But could each of you talk about how best to either follow or engage in the work you're doing, whether it's a Twitter handle or a website or whatever? I mean, would that be helpful to all of you? Okay. All right. Why don't we go
Rev.
From the end down this way? Go ahead.
Rev. K. Henderson.
You hear that?
Twitter handle. And go to Auburn website or go to groundswell-movement.org. Rev. K. Henderson.
Everybody hear that? Rev. K. Henderson. Okay. All right.
That was the Twitter.
That's a Twitter handle. All right, Linda?
So my Twitter handle is, which is where I run my mouth all day long because no one else wants to listen to me.
She does.
Is I schedule those sometimes. No, is my first initial of my name, L, and my last name, which is S-A-R-S-O-U-R. It's also my Instagram. But I also join all of you sign up to the first Muslim online organizing platform created for Muslims by Muslims. It's a progressive platform to push all issues, not just those impacting Muslim communities. And it's called, I'm very proud of it. It just launched in December and we have about 50,000 members already. It's called mpowerchange.org. M for Muslim, but you know, we didn't want to scare people too much. mpowerchange.org, and I welcome you to be part of our large progressive community pushing issues of equality and justice for all people.
Well, I know some of those answers, but not all of them. But Lindsay's here, and she's going to tell me. To get to me, it's Jay Dubensky at Tannenbaum, Tannenbaum's website. And what is our Twitter handle? At Tannenbaum Center. Okay, that's our Twitter handle. Now I know. And I will be on Twitter next week, I promise.
My Twitter is patlacat. And that is for my two children, Patrick and Laura and Catherine. So,
Pat with a C or K?
K. K-A-T-H, Patrick Cat. I do encourage you to look at the websites of the Berkeley Center at Georgetown University and the World Faiths Development Dialogue. Among other things, one of the things that I've enjoyed doing the most is interviews with remarkable people. And there are wonderful interviews, I think, with Joyce, with Paul Rauschenbusch, with Bud Heckman, with various other people who are here. They're conversations that are edited and that are sort of preserved for eternity on the 350 interviews on the website. And more, I welcome ideas on who else we should do. And then just a host of reports. We come out with Bangladesh, Senegal is cooking, refugees, tuberculosis, water, you name it. We're dealing with corruption, a topic we haven't mentioned, which I think needs some focus.
On my Twitter handle? Yeah. I'm Lori, at Lori G N Y T, L-A-U-R-I-E G N Y T. We all succumb at some point to Twitter. Anyway, I hope that, I know many of you did not get your questions answered. They were good questions, but this was always going to be just a taste, just to get your thinking going. But I hope this was helpful, and I want to thank these wonderful women panelists who I found so inspiring. Thank you very much.